Okay, good evening, everybody. My name is Nili Amit. I work at Pauline Museum as coordinator for Israel. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Eyal Nave, who will give us a lecture. As you see, I'm not going to repeat the title, but Professor, just a short introduction about Professor Nave, who is a very distinguished scholar, professor of history at Tel Aviv University. He published many books, and he specializes in the history of Israel, of modern Israel, and the history of the United States of America. Professor Nave published many books, many articles, but he also is involved in preparing textbooks for Israeli high schools, and one of his most famous textbooks was the dual narrative, Israeli and Palestinian. This book spurred a lot of controversy because it was a very innovative. The mere fact of introducing the two parallel narratives, one Israeli, one Palestinian, in the same book and the same page vis-a-vis, and it was such a controversy in Israel that the news about this textbook even made the first page of the New York Times. So you can see that Professor Nave is very innovative and courageous, and it's a great pleasure to have him here to lecture to us tonight about the beginnings of a modern Israel. Eyal, bakasha.
Good evening, everyone. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the organizer for inviting me to this place. And I feel familiar because every summer I'm giving some workshop to this particular place, and wonderful to be here again. My topic is rather not that attractive, I think, but I emphasize to make this topic because no one can understand Israel without analyzing a little bit the 70 years that preceded the creation of the Jewish state. In 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, the end of November, the United Nations declare a resolution that offer the creation of two states in what is known as Mandatory Palestine, one Jewish, one Arabic. Only one state had been created so far, only a Jewish state. And this state is celebrating this year 70 years. I think my lecture will help to understand why only one state was created. I will not explain why the Palestinian state was not created. This is a different lecture. But in order to understand why the Jewish state was able to create, to be created, and somehow to implement a diplomatic decision, we should go back to the 70 years that preceded Israel independence. The period from the rising of the Zionist movement, mainly in Central and Eastern Europe, up to 1948, the official declaration of Israel's independence. And I call this period a budding state, state in the process, state that started to develop. I think without understanding the development of this budding state, no one can explain how Israel was able to implement the United Nations resolution, and by certain logic, to understand why the other side, which did not have a budding state, despite the fact that they were the majority in the area, are still this very day unable to do it, or maybe they will do it later. So basically, we are going to talk about a period of around 70 years, which characterized the creation of modern Jewish Zionist community in Palestine. In Hebrew, we call it the Yeshuv period, which means the pre-state period, when you create a Jewish Zionist community in a state, but it is not a sovereign state. And this will be the chronology of our lecture today. I would like to emphasize that Poland has a very central role in this time period for various reasons that I will go through the lectures. But just to mention that if you look in 1948 about the population that comprised the coming Jewish state, the majority of this population came from Polish, from Poland ancestors. And this very fact explains certain impact that I'll be more specific later. I define the headline and the title Aliyah. Aliyah means immigration, but not only immigration, it's also ascend, climbing up, which means that from a Zionist perspective, to come to Palestine, and not just to immigrate to Palestine, it's some sort of an climbing up, you ascend. While if you leave the country, you call it Yerida, which means you descend. You see the meaning in this kind of a term. And then kibbutz, which is something that does not have English translation, but we are talking about certain collective community with certain characteristics that I will explain later. Yeah. As you can see, there are at least 8 sub-chapters to the lecture, so I can go on and on for 3 hours, obviously, but I won't bother you, don't worry. We will do the lecture, as I promised, 1 hour and 15 minutes, and then we will leave about 15 minutes for questions. So it all together will take, from now on, about 1 hour and 30 minutes. As you can see, it's kind of a chronological and thematic approach. The first two topics will deal with demography. Demography under the Ottoman period, which somehow is the first and the second wave of Jewish immigration, and demography under the mandate period, the British mandate period, the third and fourth and fifth wave of immigration. Then I will move to discuss, in a general term, economy and society, city-village relationship, agriculture, commerce, union, and obviously will emphasize this very characteristic, the nature of the kibbutz. Then we'll go briefly to politics, external and internal Jewish politics during this area, and then to culture. And when we'll finish this culture, I will emphasize the Polish impact on this Zionist culture that developed during this period. If we'll have time, and I hope, we'll continue with the military development and then somehow we'll pave the way for the years following World War II that were able to implement this process of creation of a Jewish state, and I'll finish here. So today we won't talk about Israel. We will talk till Israel had been officially created. I hope this is quite clear. So, in the Ottoman period, the origin of Zionists emerged in Europe, and the major main power that came to embrace Zionist cause were Eastern European Jews who reside in what is called the Pale of Settlement, something that includes today the Baltic Seas, up to, from Baltic Sea up to the Red Sea, but with very heavy and dense population in what is known as Poland. At the time when the Zionist movement emerged, there was no Poland as a political entity. It was divided by Prussia, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. But most of the Jews really reside in this Pale of Settlement, which heavy emphasis on Poland, Belarus, Lithuania, Ukraine, and European Russia. Yeah, and the Zionist movement was the national movement of the Jews, but it comprised only 2% of the Jewish population. Most of the Jews resisted to join the Zionist movement. Because Zionism wanted to implement itself out of Europe, in what they call the old ancestral land of the Jewish people. Whether it was there or not, it's not important. What is important is that the Zionist narrative from the beginning look at what they call Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, as the origin of Jewish peoplehood. And as a modern national movement, like many other national movements, they claim to revive this Jewish connection to the land. But as you can see, most of the land was populated with non-Jewish population. All these brown dots are Arabs, nomads, villagers, city people, and the Jews usually were a very small minority, no more than 50,000 people out of 300,000 people that lived at what they call the holy city, Sefer, Tiberias, Jerusalem, Hebron, and some of them in not holy city like Jaffa. Among these people, they were not Zionist. They were considered to be what the Zionists called the old Jewish settlement in Palestine, the old Yeshuv, namely non-Zionist Jews, basically religious, that lived there, but were not connected to the Zionist movement that emerged in Europe as a modern phenomenon, claiming to recreate a Jewish society, a productive society that will begin again out of Europe in what they call the land of Israel, whatever it means. But the old Yeshuv was there prior to the emergence of the Zionist movement and prior to the arrival of Zionist Jews in the first and second wave of immigration. The first wave of immigration that endured from 1881 to 1904, in fact, were from Eastern Europe. Yes, Polish Jews as well, but there was no Poland at that time. So basically with Russian tradition, they were largely middle-class traditional Jews. About 30,000, 35,000 immigrants who came to Palestine to be productive and to create productive villages. A very small portion came later from Yemen, about 5,000 Jews. And these were, in fact, the first wave of Zionist immigration. Although the Yemenite immigration would not consider themselves Zionist, they were Messianic Jews who, out of religious belief, thought that they should go to Palestine. And they were brought for all kinds of reasons by the European Jews who came to Palestine. Well, as you can see, the idea was to be a pioneer. The idea was to create a productive infrastructure and to work the land and to toil the land, and usually it failed. Diseases, clash with local Arab, lack of experience in agriculture and harsh climate almost put an end to this endeavor. And it was saved, as usual, by a rich Jewish philanthropist, Rothschild, the French Rothschild, who was able to donate some money so the early settlement will continue to exist. But within this whole project, the beginning of a Jewish society starts. And you can see some symbols, some ideological ideas to create a productive society, a Hebrew-speaking society, and somehow to create a just society, which was always part of the Zionist horizon, the Zionist aspiration. Whether it was achieved or not, well, it is questionable, but it was always this utopian part of Zionism that you can see even in the first wave of immigration, which was basically petit bourgeois, middle class from Eastern European shtetl, usually traditional people who wanted to be pioneers, chalutzim, and to be productive. Well, the real fusion of Zionism came in the second Aliyah, the second wave of Jewish immigration, which came from the same origin, Eastern Europe, but most of the immigrants were socialists in their ideology. And they were largely educated, young intellectuals that already were Zionist in Eastern Europe and knew Hebrew, and have this, you know, this ideal of creating a classless society. And in an empty place, they thought that the place is empty. And therefore, they thought they can create from the beginning a classless society with no need to break and destroy the bourgeois structure. They want manual labor and also productive, but they were socialists and they thought that everything should be collective, no private property, they will work together. Socialism for them was some sort of national aspiration, social aspiration, and philosophical aspiration. To be socialist is to be a complete human being. And obviously there were ideological clashes between the second wave of immigration and the first one, because the first one were not socialists. They were people who have their land. To make things short, this member of second wave of immigration almost failed, but then the Zionist institution stepped in, and a guy by the name Arthur Rupin, in fact, a German social planner and sociologist, was able to found the Palestinian office of the Zionist movement. In fact, the office enabled many of the projects of the second wave of immigration. I want to emphasize two projects, because for me these two projects are the pillars of the Zionist Foundation. One project is what they call Kvutza, later on became Kibbutz. Dgania, at the shore of the Sea of Galilee, was a project that Rupin financed. He gave collective land to a group of people to create the first collective community on the shore of the Galilee Sea by the name Dgania. Dgania is considered to be the first kibbutz, and I'll be more specific later what are the major characteristics of this kibbutz. Although at that time it was known as kvutza, not as a kibbutz, because the idea was to keep it small and not big. Usually, you know, Israelis, the language Hebrew is very strange. When people are small, say small, it means it became feminine, kvutza. When it came big, it became masculine, kibbutz. This is one of the pillars, because this is the first modern, secular, collective experiment to create a just society and some sort of a utopian society. And it came out of necessity, because they did not have land, they did not have money, and Rupin, in fact, bought the land as a collective land, and somehow they start a collective labor there. The second pillar is the creation of the first modern city, Achuzat Bayit, later known as Tel Aviv. The same people of the second Aliyah participate in these two projects. And therefore, from the beginning, the rift between city and country, between urban and rural society, was not that strong among the first Zionist settlers. because they were the same people coming from Eastern Europe. They talk the same language. I will not emphasize today all the trouble of the Palestinian society, which were the majority at that time, but one of the troubles that they have was a split between the rural Palestinian, the Falah, the kind of servant, and the urban center of the Palestinian people, which hardly talk with each other. And in fact, if you look at Europe, in Eastern Europe also, in many places, one of the great problems of the Eastern European society was the big difference between city and country. One of the unique kind of advantages of the Zionist movement and the Yishuv from the beginning was that in terms of modern development, I'm not talking about the old city of Jerusalem, but in terms of modern endeavor, country and city were basically combined because the people were the same. So you can grow up in Tel Aviv, and your son and daughter will go to the kibbutz when they'll be 18 years old. And in that sense, you have certain solidarity that developed out of necessity, not out of ideology, between country and city. Well, at the end of this period, the member of the first and second Aliyah, first and second wave of immigration in 1914, were able to establish few settlements, an urban center next to Jaffa, Tel Aviv, another one next to Haifa, and basically rural projects, some of them private-oriented villages, some of them already collective-oriented, and most of them mixed. And you see that they were spread along the coastal line, what is known the Israeli Valley and the Eastern Galilee. These were basically the major geographic location of the beginning of the modern Zionist community in Palestine. Well, 100 years ago, Great Britain conquered the area as a result of World War I, and 100 years ago, exactly 5 days ago, November 2nd, the Zionists were able to get an unofficial promise from the British Foreign Minister, Lord Balfour, known as the Balfour Declaration, telling you the truth. Most of the people in Israel hardly know what is the Balfour Declaration. But it became a very, very important document for Palestinians to show the great betrayal and the great colonialist nature of the Zionist endeavor. Without entering into the debate, I will tell you that the Balfour Declaration at the time was a private endeavor, a private project of this guy, Chaim Weizmann, a British scientist, now disguised in Arab custom, because he met with Faisal in a very strange picture, but he was the leader of the Zionist movement in Great Britain, and he was able to get the Balfour Declaration as an unofficial letter from Balfour to Lord Rothschild, somehow looking favorably towards creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, providing that none of the rights of the non-Jewish population will be impeded or impaired. But the Balfour Declaration later was implemented and redefined within the mandate, period, and within the first British white paper, which was basically supportive of the Zionist movement, although there was some paragraph in this white paper that Great Britain somehow will control the Jewish immigration that cannot be so great in volume as to exceed whatever may be the economic capacity of the country. So this kind of paragraph was not implemented at that time, but gave certain way of looking at the future. If something will happen, Great Britain have the right to stop immigration, which did not happen so far. And indeed, during the 20s and the 30s, the two decades that Palestine was under British control, more wave of immigration took place. More waves of Zionist or Jewish immigration to Palestine took place. The reason for it are basically suffering of Jews in the place of origin and initial Zionist sympathy, which made them moving to Palestine rather than to the United States or Canada or South Africa or Australia or other places. So we can talk about the third Aliyah, the third wave of immigration that resulted from the Bolshevik Revolution and major riots against Jews, mainly by the White Army during the Civil War. So many people that already were Zionists used this opportunity to immigrate to Palestine. And in a sense, the people from the third wave of immigration were the same people like those who came in the second wave of immigration. And indeed, they create this kind sort of the young socialist society in Palestine and gave it kind of a normative status. And since they were so able to write and to talk and to engage in all kind of political organization, they in fact started to create this new modern culture of Palestine and also to increase the experimentation that started by the second wave of immigration of the kibbutz. But there were only another 35,000 people, no more than that. And although they create the socialist infrastructure, the majority of the Jews in Palestine were not socialist. And in the mid-20s, with the fourth wave of immigration, a huge non-socialist number of bourgeois Jews, primarily from Poland, emigrated to Palestine. When I say huge, I say in comparison to the other wave of immigration. So far, the first and the second and the third wave of immigration altogether maybe reached 70,000 people. And suddenly, overnight, another 70,000 people come. Most of them originate in Poland. At that time, there is a Poland as a political entity. And we know that 10% of the Polish population are Jews, and minority of them are supported or somehow have affinity to the Zionist movement. Some of them are really active, most of them passive Zionist supporter. 1948, the United States closed its gate for free Jewish immigration, so many of them out of default came to Palestine. And therefore, they have these images of not really idealistic Zionists. Because they came because the United States was closed, which was not true. Other people, other places were open. There were Zionists, but they were not. Most of them were not socialists. They were middle-class, educated, urban Jews, and less ideological than this pioneer-like member of the second and the third Aliyah. And they have very small. They were not rich, but some of them have small capital, so they invest private capital and somehow promoted the Jewish urban settlements. So you can see here, again, despite the fact that there are rural settlements, agricultural settlements, collective-based, with the fourth Aliyah from Poland, you will see the major urban, modern base of places like Tel Aviv, Haifa, modern Jerusalem, not old Jerusalem, modern Jerusalem, many of them came from this wave of fourth wave of immigration that came from Poland. In the 30s, well, late in the 20s, this wave of immigration stopped to a certain point because there was an urban crisis, and many of these people left back to Europe. But they create this kind of a social infrastructure by having these youth movements and other social organizations that many of them originate in Poland, like Shomer HaTzair, the Young Guard, already in 1913, and obviously Beitar in the 20s. In the 30s, we are talking of another wave of immigration, and again, mostly middle class, bourgeois immigrant. Some of them went to the country, but most of them went to the city. They came from Poland, from Germany, from Romania. It was an outcome of the rise of the Nazi to power in Germany and the spreading of Eastern European anti-Semitism all over Europe. And they settled mainly in urban centers and led a major demographic increase in the Jewish population because they were about 200,000. Only 30% of them came from Germany. And for some reason, we call it the German immigration or the German wave of immigration, but there were more Polish Jews in this immigration than from Germany. So why we call it the German? Because it was unique. It was different than the other, because till then, most of the sources of the manpower who came to Palestine came from Eastern Europe and came from Zionist background of Eastern European Jews who initially decided not to live in Eastern Europe. While the German who came really out of default, they have no other choice. Many of them indeed were German patriots who have nothing to do with Zionism, and here they came. And also they changed the profile, the social profile of the Yeshuv. But you need to remember that even in the fifth wave of immigration, the majority of the immigrants came from Eastern Europe, primarily from Poland. That's the reason that you have such a Polish core in the Jewish society of Palestine during the 20s and the 30s. What were the economy that developed? As I told you, and now I will re-emphasize it, a combination of city and country life, a combination of rural experiment and urban development, a combination of private money and collective money that came by all kind of contributor and all kind of means. And therefore, from the beginning, you will see that this society is developed as a European modern enclave in a place which is not yet that modern. And therefore, it was able to exist by having this balance between the urban center that developed in the 20s and the 30s, and the continuation of new rural settlement known as kibbutzim and moshavim. There were slight difference between a kibbutz and a moshav. They are all rural settlement, agricultural settlement that have market economy, but the kibbutz is totally collective, while the moshav is only partially collective. The land is common and then divided to people, but then they can earn their private income from working the land. And there is private property in the moshav with certain internal taxes that create some mutual fund, and the land is commonly divided, but the outcome of the land is privately and unequal distributed, depends on your ability to work, to do market, to do business. While in the kibbutzim, at that time, everything is collective, no private experiments. which lead me now to a little bit more, I would say, detailed emphasis on this phenomena known as kibbutz. The highlight of the kibbutz population in Palestine was in 1947, when 7.5% of the population reside in kibbutz. Then it diminished, and in the first three decades of the country, the percentage of the kibbutznik was around 2%. Now it's less than 1%. So what is the big deal? Why the image of the kibbutz is so widespread? I think there are various reasons, and most of the reasons are connected to this unique project that endured for 70 years. Unique collective project without legal system that enforced people to be in this project, yet this project was able to create certain society that the whole world looked with surprise and was amazed to see. The first kibbutzim, till the mid-50s, I think, were basically agriculture-oriented, where the idea to toil the land creates some sort of a new Jew that is connected to the land, this romantic connection to the land, but he was not a farmer or a landlord, but rather a collective worker of the land. And in that sense, combine nature and rural scenery with agriculture. So it have this image of rural modern life. But it's beyond that. I think the most amazing phenomena that the kibbutz experiments, or the kibbutz experience, at least till the 1990s or 1980s, was what they call collective education, collective childhood. The idea was to liberate the family from the kids, basically. To liberate and to create kind of a gender-wise equal society between male and female, which was not the case, but at least on the idea. And therefore, every child in a kibbutz family was put into a collective process of education. From its early childhood, after a few months or after a year, he was or she was within what they call Bet Yeladim, which is the house of children. They lived there, they slept there, they have only 2 or 3 hours time with their family. When the parents are finishing work at 4 p.m., the kids are coming to their places, they have 3 hours, and at 7 p.m., they go back to their dorms. You can talk about these kids today. They're very angry. But at the time, it was perceived as a modern experiment of collective education. Even John Dewey, the great educator, was amazed about this project, the project of collective childhood. And collective education, I think, was one of the major unique phenomena that gave the kibbutz such a visibility, such a central role in the Israeli society. And many of these kids who grew up in the 40s and 50s and 60s became later on part of the Israeli society, but also perceived themselves as elite part of the Israeli society. Which gives me to the third point. From the beginning, maybe not from the beginning, not from Degania, but from the 30s and on, obviously the 40s, the kibbutz was perceived as modeling for the new national Hebrew identity. Not everyone will be a kibbutznik, but a kibbutznik is, you know, you aspire that one in your family will be kibbutznik. People like my mother, who grew up in urban Givatayim, went to a youth movement, knowing that at the end, when we'll finish the youth movement, and she'll go to the kibbutz. The idea was that it's a kind of the elite way to be a real Hebrew, modern person is through the kibbutz. Obviously, she did not go to the kibbutz because she found my father, and that's it. But kibbutz was still, I think, up to the late 70s, early 80s, perceived as the most idealistic and modern and just way of creating a modern society, the Hebrew society. And in that sense, it was combined to the overall national aspiration. Ben-Gurion always said that he dreamt to be in a kibbutz. Eshkol, the third prime minister, was a kibbutznik from Degania, but he never lived in Degania. He was very active as a politician, so he had to live in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So, Rabin's parents were socialists. The idea was that here you create somehow, you implement socialism as your way of life. And therefore, you have this utopian element of human engineering, of human modernity, of human change. I mean, you change this old Jewish fallen figure into healthy, happy, you know, authentic Israeli. These images melt together. So the collective experiment, the nature, the national role, and I would say the kind of a new personality building, which they somehow melted all together in order to create this role model of the kibbutz as the avant-garde of the new modern Yeshuv, and later on, new modern Israeli. And it manifested itself in politics, in the army, in other places, till it finished. It was finished in the around the 80s. By the way, today, 90% of the kibbutz are not collective projects anymore. Almost all the kibbutz had privatized themselves and became kind of a nice suburb places where people want to have a little house and a little nature, but they have their own salary, although they have certain mutual assistance system. So this is the essence of the kibbutz, and it endured because it was combined with the national ethos of the overall labor-oriented Zionist society. So even if you are not in a kibbutz, usually you praise collective endeavor, union association, and all sort of these kind of a non-private property owning beyond the percentage of the kibbutznik. Even in the city, people were in the unions, the working and the labor power was the largest power at the time. And yes, there were private enterprises and private factories, but the major development was collective, and even in a city when you have collective endeavor, or collective factory, collective firm, or collective commerce chain, it was always associated with the member of the kibbutz. Now I will move briefly to politics. Well, I think one of the major advantages of the yeshuv, that from the beginning, it created autonomous political institutions that were able to organize the population as a state in a process. Therefore, I call it a budding state. Not just immigration, not just social structure, not just this combination between city and country, which was relatively close, but also politics. Politics was a major instrument of organizing people according to a common goal with a certain ideology, and within a structure of various circles. At least three major circles of politics developed during the 20s and the 30s. The external circle was the creation of the Jewish Agency, which was geared towards the whole Jewish population. I'll talk about it in a moment. The intermediate circle was the official circle of the Yeshuv's autonomy. The Jewish community of Palestine have its autonomous institution. And the third circle, and I think the most crucial one, was the circle of the labor community, the socialist community. Let's talk a little bit about each of these three circles. Well, the external circle means the Jewish Agency that was created in 1929. The Jewish Agency was an overall organization attempt to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine and to help the immigrants' absorption and to purchase new land and coordinate a common policy vis-a-vis the authorities of the British Mandate and try to tie between the Zionist movement and the diaspora. I think the great success of the Jewish Agency was its ability to combine within its institution both Jewish Zionist and non-Zionist organization. By appealing to the non-Zionist Jewish Federation, primarily in Western Europe and the United States, and to the Zionist organization all over Europe, and put them under the umbrella of the Jewish Agency, while the head of the Jewish Agency is also the head of the World Zionist Organization, Chaim Weizmann, in fact, the Zionist movements, which were no more than 2% of the Jewish population, were able to provide the major political agency to speak the voice of the Jews. Although no one asked the non-Zionist if this is their voice, by being able to have the Jewish Federation within the Jewish Agency, in fact, I would say, institution that was the idea of Chaim Weizmann was really claiming to be the governance of the Jews vis-a-vis the world. And it was very instrumental in the 40s, obviously, but even before. The second is what we call the Yeshuv Institution. These are the National Committee, and the General Assembly, the Representative Assembly, not that powerful organization because the sovereignty was in the hand of the British authority, but British authority delegate certain power to create a Jewish autonomy, and the National Committee managed to deal with mundane issues like health, education, welfare, religious. I think the importance of this institution was that it practiced politics among the members of the Yeshuv. Every 4 years, people went to election, they elect people to a representative assembly that nominate the national committee that handles certain issues. So you have here some sort of a laboratory of politics that enable these people to engage in some sort of self-rule or autonomy existence. But I think that the most important institution was the Histadrut. Histadrut is, only if you're Bolshevik, you can understand what does it mean, Histadrut. It is an umbrella institution that combines both the union and the factories and the companies. So it creates, it was the bigger employer, and it united all the employees. Well, good that you are not Americans, because Americans do not understand how a person can be in the same time both an employer and a worker and an employee. This was the idea that Ben-Gurion took from his Bolshevik time, and he was the head of the Istadrut. In a sense, he created an organization that controlled the major economic activities of the yeshuv by creating the major big companies of the yeshuv, like Solel Bonet and Bank HaPoalim, that at that time was under the Istadrut. So in fact, the Istadrut was an umbrella labor organization that united both the companies and all the unions. But this was not its major way to control and to power. The Istadrut provide healthcare to its member. And you need to be a member of the Istadrut with a red ticket in order to get healthcare. The Istadrut have good schools. The Istadrut have publishing house. The Istadrut have a journal that was the most popular journal at the time. The Istadrut even engaged in foreign affairs and illegal defense issue by having, at least till the 30s, the major underground defense organization, Haganah, under its control. So here you see real estate within a state. But what about the fact that most of the people, especially those who came in the fourth and fifth wave of immigration from Poland, were not socialists, like my grandfather. But he needs health. He needs healthcare. Healthcare. He was not socialist, but he needs healthcare. So he have a red ticket. So in a sense, the Istadrut was able to control the organized yeshuv by providing it with major function that usually the state is doing. And my mother, that came from a father who was never a socialist, when she went to school, obviously he sent her to a socialist school because the education level were better there. So by controlling the educational system, by controlling culture, and above all by controlling the health system, in fact the Histadrut was able to create some sort of a state within a state. And it's not surprised that the first leader of the Istadrut was David Ben-Gurion, that you heard about him last time, right? And his way to power was through the Istadrut, through controlling the Istadrut. To these institutions, we should add political parties. To make things short, since the 30s, the political internal party system is indeed comprised of three sections. The hegemonic Labour Socialist Party in red, yeah, Mapai, headed by Ben-Gurion, never more than 35% of the population. But it was able to do coalition with the civic liberal bloc that was always separated, never united, and with Sephardic ethnic blocs which were also united, and some religious bloc that were divided to Sephardi and Ashkenazi. The major asset of the labor bloc is its ability to control the organized yeshuv. Only in the late 20s, a real opposition developed to the organized yeshuv headed by the labor. And this opposition was by the most famous Polish Zionist leader, Zev Jabotinsky, who created in the late 20s the Revisionist Party, and in the mid-30s, secede from the Zionist organization and create what he calls New Zionism. But fortunately for the organized yeshuv, His power in the organization was less than 10%. His power in Poland was almost 40%. His power in Lithuania was 60%. But in the organized Yeshuv, he somehow disassociated himself from the mechanism of power, providing an overall opposition on every issue, political, diplomatic, military, obviously social, to the organized Yeshuv, or to the control, labor-controlled organized Yeshuv, on almost every issue. Jabotinsky was the great opponent of the organized Yeshuv, and in that sense was stigmatized as illegitimate. You can also put it within the ideological cleavage between right and left in the late 30s, the left associated with European socialism, the right is associated with European ultra-nationalism and fascism. So although he was never endorsing fascist ideology, he was kind of an old-style liberal, he endorsed or have connection with the Italian fascists and Polish nationalists, and in that sense was stigmatized by Ben-Gurion and the majority of the organized Yeshuv as belong to an illegitimate camp known as the right wing. Obviously, the irony of history is that Menachem Begin became the prime minister in 1977, bringing the right wing to be the controlled party since the last 40 years, most of the time. But at that time, it was outcast. Well, this brings me to the last characteristics of the Yeshuv, namely the culture. From the beginning, the development of this society was associated with cultural issue. Above all, the revival of the Hebrew language. That was a project not less important than toiling the land or creating political institutions. The idea of culture, the teachers, the intellectuals, were always very, very crucial to the development of this new national Hebrew-style society. Hebrew became an ideological demand. You should speak Hebrew as an instrument of identity. Even if you know Yiddish better, don't use it, only in private talks, only in your family. But Hebrew is the public sphere. Hebrew is the public place, and therefore, people like Ben Yehuda and later on these whole teachers and scholars who forcefully forced themselves to speak Hebrew, some of them in quite, I would say, old age of their life, is a very interesting phenomenon. To revive a dead language in two generations. And obviously those people who were born in the 40s and 30s already in Palestine with Hebrew as their first language, like my mother, for example, were the first generation who, in fact, normally spoke Hebrew. But this whole issue is something that is very surprising because it succeeded. It succeeded first because it was intentionally directed toward success, and it was part of the negation of the diaspora mentality, which means you negate also your ability to speak a diasporic or exile language, namely the Yiddish. Not that people did not know Yiddish, they knew Yiddish, the older generation, but they forced themselves not to use Yiddish on the public sphere. And this Hebrew language revived a whole Hebrew culture in various manifestations, especially in the 30s. You can see it in architecture, you can see it in art, in music, and in dance, which is a unique issue. You know, from the beginning, the Jewish Yeshuv was able to create a very interesting form of folk dance. And till this very day, Israel is a dance empire. Yeah, not this kind of dance anymore, although old people are still able to dance horror in these circles, which is some sort of a symbolic issue, because it's not a decadent dance like waltz or tango. It's a collective dance with bond of camaraderie, yeah, with bond together. And usually people even don't touch too much each other, just the hands. Today it's not that fashionable anymore, but in my age, yeah, to dance folk dance was an argument, was some sort of an issue, that a statement. And if you dance, for example, waltz or tango, you belong to the old world. And if you dance rock and roll, well, this is totally decadence. This is something that's unheard of. I was expelled from the youth movement because I participated in a rock and roll party once, which was unbelievable in the 60s. You cannot go to these places. Yeah. Because these kind of dance was typically new Hebrew manifestation. Again, today I think we dance either waltz or rock and roll. Yeah. But we are not Zionist in that sense anymore. Also, we dance some religious dances, which is something else. But I am not talking about this. I think the last point of culture is the create of this new identity of the Sabra. The Sabra is the people who were born already in the Yeshuv, in the 20s, in the 30s, in the 40s. People that did not have this kind of intoxicating connection with exile, with diaspora, with being persecuted by the other, proud, normal, natural, a little bit rude, somehow totally insensitive to all kind of nuances, masculine, even if you're a woman. This is the Sabra mentality that was part and parcel of the Jewish identity, this Jewish developed identity of the Yeshuv, and endure, I think, till the 60s. It's also gone now. But still, within the edge of all sorts of tourist information, you still have all kind of Sabra symbols that still existed. So we create a society and a culture and an identity and economic structure and political institution, and all this together, in a sense, enable these 500,000 people in the late 30s to behave as if they have already are a sovereign state, although they were not a sovereign state. What were the Polish connection of this community? And I think it is a topic that should be emphasized. As I told you, from a very empirical research, most of these people came from Poland. The demography, the largest segment of the population of the Yeshuv in the late 30s and in the eve of independence, late 40s, came from Polish society, from Polish culture, from you know, there was a joke that one neighborhood in Warsaw is like the whole Oriental Jews who came from North Africa in terms of population. But even prior to the Holocaust, if you look at 1939 demographic census, about 40% of the population who reside in the Yeshuv came from Poland, which were the larger majority. Yet, it was not so distinct because, unlike the German Jews who continue to talk German and have this German manner, the Polish Jews did not want to associate so much with Polish identity, in a sense. But if you look at it in a more deep angle and you try to analyze the essence of the Zionist ideology, you can see that among all the European national movement, the Polish national movement is the most influential and had the largest impact on the Zionist movement. For reason that when the Zionist movement emerged in Eastern Europe, Poland did not have a sovereign state, and also the Jews did not have sovereign state. So there were a lot of intellectual connection between intellectual leaders among the national movement of Jews, the Zionism, and intellectual leaders of Poland. There were also movement or connection between non-Zionist national Jews, like the autonomists, the territorialists, or member of the Bund. But the whole idea was that Poland provided a sort of a suffering brother that have the same, well, say, the same terrible situation as the Jews. They used to have a state, and the state was gone, is occupied by foreign forces, and as a Polish nationalist, you aspire to revive your former state. So Jews can really somehow find common denominator with this form of nationalism. They were influenced also by British nationalism, but Great Britain did not lose a state. And this whole deep issue of not just reviving a national movement, but rather creating an old new state has a lot of parallel with Polish nationalism. And when Poland get its independence after World War I, for a short period, there was some sort of really honeymoon between Polish leaders and Zionist leaders, not just Zionists, Jewish national leaders, which then, I think, after the end of Pilsudski regime, somehow ended. The third point, and here I try to be very, very delicate because I opened the door for a lot of debates. There is an argument lately argued by some Jewish historians in the United States that Polish support, especially revisionist Zionism, right-wing Zionism, Begin, Jabotinsky, somehow is related to Polish anti-Semitism, because the Polish anti-Semites did not want Jews in Poland. And in that sense, looking at Jews as undesirable people somehow have this combination with this right-wing Zionism that also did not want Jews in Poland. They want them in Palestine. And many, anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic Poles play with the idea that they should help those Jews who want to leave Poland and to go up to Palestine. And among the Zionists, the right-wing Zionism, especially Jabotinsky and Begin, in fact, also argued that there is no future for Jews in Poland. So in a sense, in a very peculiar way, Polish anti-Semitism was Zionism. Well, this argument of this is very debated and heated. Also because all of kind of ramification that how come that you are anti-Jewish and pro-Zionist. But look at it on a more deeper level and try to see some sort of common denominator between those people in Europe who did not want Jews to be in Europe and those extreme Zionists that say that there is no place for Jews in Europe and they should move to Palestine therefore. So in that sense, you have this argument. Again, careful. Careful, if you go more case by case, there were also philo-Semitic, non-Jewish, Polish who support Zionism. It's not that clear cut, but there is some argument here that lately became creates such a fierce debate among historians. And then I will move to the unempiric and unable to measure element of culture. If you have 40% of the population come from Polish origin, and after the Holocaust, you have another 300,000 Polish Jews who came, in a sense, you create some sort of an unofficial Polish culture in Palestine. And although you don't like to manifest it, but manners, politeness, Polish food, the smell of the food. Sometimes when you go to certain places of Tel Aviv, you smell like Warsaw. You know, certain food. Fashion. Well, it was looked by the young Sabre as something that you don't want to imitate. But what about the old people? What about those who really miss Poland when they came to Palestine? Who really missed high culture of Poland when they came to Palestine? Who really missed the porcelain and the nice furniture that they have in Polish house? Who really missed the Polish food? So they have it in Tel Aviv. Sometimes. Which create a lot of jokes about Poland. A humor, Polish humor. There's a lot of Polish humor in this Yeshuv community. And you can see it in architectures, in urban development. You can see it in the Hebrew University, although everybody say Martin Buber and a German scholar. No, before Martin Buber came, the majority of Hebrew University professors were from Polish origin. And then infiltrated to higher education and to elementary education. Yeah, they did not talk Polish because it was part of, you know, create a new identity. But they eat Polish food. And when they go to a concert, they have this Polish customs and fashion and hat in Tel Aviv. To the point, and it's personal, that I visited Poland the first time only 10 years ago. And when I came back, I told my parents, you know, I felt at home. Although I don't know even one word in Polish, I felt at home. The food, the smell, the porcelain, the jokes, the humor, when you translated it to English, the body language. Something that you cannot measure and you cannot put it in an empirical way, but it's a part of a culture. And, you know, this is kind of a Jewish chalutz in Poland. When I look at this monument around Poland here, I see the same person. Strong, young, national, masculine. So in a sense, you have a lot of cultural common denomination that should not be overlooked. Well, I need to finish in a moment, but just want to tell you that all these infrastructure that I just analyzed enable the Jews during the great clash that started in the mid-30s against the Arab to win the war against the Arab. Basically, the Arab start their national endeavor in the mid-30s. Against Great Britain and the Zionists as a form of European colonialism. They engage in a violent Arab revolt that contribute enormously to the Zionists by having combined forces with the British authority. The Great Arab Revolt ended with the breakdown of the Palestinian society. I don't want to go into detail, but it also enabled the Jewish forces to be much more effective by having British support during the late 30s. And despite the fact that in the late 30s, Great Britain started to dissociate itself from political support of Zionism on practical level because both forces had to fight the Great Arab Revolt, Great Britain contributed enormously to the creation or to the development of the Haganah, which was the major paramilitary militia of the Zionist movement that already was created in the 20s, but was really incapable of operating till the mid or the late 30s. And they operate in a twofold way, cooperation with Great Britain and some sort of opposition to Great Britain, especially when Great Britain embarked on the White Paper. There are other two minor forces, the Irgun and the Lehi, which I don't want to go into detail. Altogether, these two forces were less than 5%. And now they are still on the public image. But I want to go further just in the last 5 minutes before I open the floor for questions, that during the 40s, when Great Britain somehow dissociated itself from supporting the Zionist aspiration by the White Paper of 1939, in fact, there was no time to resist the White Paper because the war started and Ben-Gurion said that we must help British in the struggle as if there was no White Paper, and we must resist the White Paper as if there was no war. And usually most of the organized community of the Jews, the Yeshuv, helped Great Britain and did not resist Great Britain, and in that sense exemplify its political maturity. This helped create the Palmach, which was the operative unit of the Haganah that later on became the skeleton of the IDF. And the Palmach also have these two goals. One goal is to resist the White Paper, and the other goal was to cooperate or to benefit from the cooperation with Great Britain. One splinter organization in the Irgun decided not to cooperate and create the Lehi, the Stern Gang. I think it's not that important at that time to the overall picture. Anyhow, after the war, the struggle against Great Britain started when both members of the Haganah and the Irgun started on an anti-British operation that somehow aimed to open the gate of the land to the refugees that were all around Europe. This phase of struggle was basically on illegal immigration and illegal settlement, but in few months, between November 45 and June 46, it also extended into real violent activities against Great Britain. This operation ended with the Black Saturday reaction of Great Britain and the arrest in detention camp, the major leader of the Yeshuv. At that point, the Yeshuv had to face whether to continue to struggle or to move to diplomatic pressure and end the struggle. And the maturity of the Yeshuv had been exemplified by the decision to stop the struggle after the King David violent attack on British headquarters in Jerusalem. The political leader of the Yeshuv, both Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, realized that it is counterproductive to waste power against an empire that anyhow will leave these places, because the future should be is very ominous, and in the future we should concentrate on building our force against whoever will oppose the very creation of the state. I think this was a crucial decision to stop the military struggle and to engage only in political issue, namely to convince the great power and other people that a Jewish state should be implemented and should be created as part of the New World Order. As a result, in 1947, major activities of the Zionist leader were geared towards diplomatic and political issue rather than military struggle. Only the splinter group of the Irgun and the Stern Gang continued their activity, but with all due respect for their heroism, these activities, I think, were insignificant. The real significant issue was to convince the new great power that after the mandate, a Jewish state should be established, and acceptance of the partition plan that namely say that the border of this Jewish state will be the border of the Jewish settlement. As I told you in the beginning of the lecture, most of the Jews were concentrated on the coastal line, the Israel Valley, and the Eastern Galilee. And these were the real border of the partition plan. The great achievement of Zionist leader was to incorporate an empty desert also into the partition plain that was really populated by Numid people, and the Palestinians got their own places which they resisted. I don't want to go into detail what are the major reasons for these outcome and this resistance. The Jewish institution, except the right wing, accept this partition for various reasons, and as a result, when the United Nations really endorsed this resolution by a vote of 33 against 13 with 10 absentees, the Jews indeed reacted in real joy and dances, not knowing that the next day violent fighting will start, but also a few months after that, the State of Israel will be created. Thank you very much. Now, if you have some questions that probably I did not cover, feel free to answer, to ask.
Good evening, Carsten Gerards from the College of European Warsaw. First of all, thank you, Professor Nave, for this intriguing lecture, and excuse my probably naive question, but the name Israel, what was the role of that name during the period you covered in your lecture? As far as I know, there were discussions, we just read Hebrew State, about how to name the country in 1948, so probably yeah. You could elaborate on that. Thank you.
Yes, there were discussion whether to call it Hebrew, Israel, Eretz Israel. I mean, at the end, they decided to call Israel as a result of some Ben Gurion's decision and its influence on other politicians that it will be the most suitable name because it has connection with Judaism but does not have connection with exile Judaism. So they went back to biblical Israel, but then they went to a place that, in fact, was not that great from a biblical point of view because the kingdom of Judea endured more than the kingdom of Israel. But it's a whole romantic name that developed during the cultural battle of Zionism. And at the end, I think Ben-Gurion decided that this will be the name, without too much opposition, by the way. The debate somehow subsided in the late 40s. Okay.
In the beginning, you said that we may see the reason for Israel creating a state and Palestine not creating a state in the fact that Israel had a budding state. And then you said that there was this revolt in 1936 by Palestinians. Could you maybe say more about about Palestine in this time?
Well, the Great Palestinian Revolt of 1936 was not a budding state. It was the breaking of a budding state that had been started to develop in the early 30s. And as a result of the violent attack of the extreme militant Palestinian against Great Britain and Zionism, in fact, the Palestinian society was destroyed, totally destroyed between 36 and 39. So I think it was a great tragedy for Palestinians that they were engaged in this full-fledged violent attack against the colonial power, something that the Jews in 1946 were at the age of doing the same and then decided not to do it. So I think the budding Palestinian state started in the early 30s, but somehow was broken altogether in the Great Palestinian Revolt of 36 and 39, because the British simply expelled all the leadership, villages were ruined, economy was devastating, and internal terrorism, in fact, caused a lot of casualties among Palestinians. So again, when they started to rebuild themselves after World War II, they rebuilt a real... very weak society that cannot overcome what they call the Great Arab Revolt. But I'm not a Palestinian historian to say it. I just quote my Palestinian friend that always say that this was the crucial issue that put an end to the ability of Palestinian national movement to create its own budding state.
OK.
Okay.
Maybe I can have one more question. One about the name Yeshuv. When was it created? Because I imagine it was created after Israel already.
No, the name Yeshuv was created in the 20s after the British authority. It was never an official name. Great Britain never used this name in the official documents. The Great Britain documents is always Palestine. And at the request of the Zionist leader, when they translate Palestine to Hebrew, they put Palestina Eretz Israel. Palestine, Eretz Israel. Never Yeshuv. The Yeshuv was an attempt by the unofficial modern Zionist society to distinguish itself from the non-Zionists, the old Yeshuv, those religious guys who settled in Palestine before the immigration, and to distinct themselves from the rest of the Jews who are not part of the Yeshuv, but still have either supported Zionism in Europe or indifferent to Zionism or anti-Zionism. So the Yeshuv was kind of an unofficial jargon, unofficial slang that had been adopted already in the 20s, and you see it in internal letters and internal newspaper. Later on, when historian of the State of Israel tried to characterize this period, they call it the Yeshuv period. Like the Americans say, the colonial period for the pre-independent, pre-state period. So this was the Yeshuv. And the Yeshuv is, in Hebrew, have a lot of meaning. Yeshuv is kind of a generic term for settlement. Neither kibbutz, nor moshav, nor moshava, nor town, settlement, kind of in a generic way. And yeshuv is also something that is to sit down. So part of yoshev means that you are rooted in the land. You are not free-floating diasporic Jews, which has a lot of ideological meaning as well. Yeah.
Dzień dobry. Ja mam takie pytanie a propos białych ksiąg. Czy one nie... One tak jakby zmierzały do ograniczenia imigracji Żydów do Palestyny? Czy w związku z tym nie czują oni takiego rozżalenia, że nie mogą tam przybyć? I jakie były plany, żeby to jakby to ominąć? Dziękuję.
Yeah. The last white paper, 1939, was really an attempt to restrict Jewish immigration to Palestine. And somehow this contradicted the Jewish aspiration. And in a sense, it opened a wave of resistance to the white paper that endured 4 months, from May 1939 till September 1939. Because the moment the war started, the Zionist or the Yeshuv had to face a dilemma, to continue to struggle against the white paper or to help Great Britain against Hitler. Not that Great Britain wanted this help, but the idea is that you continue to struggle British administration in Palestine, while British is the only power that somehow faced Hitler, was unheard of. And therefore, practically, there was no anti-white paper measures throughout the war. When the war ended and the white paper was not ended, and the British policy continued to stop immigration and settlement, the Zionists embark on a policy known as limited struggle, namely that try to break the siege by illegal immigration and try to break the obstruction and the law not to settle by illegal settlement. But practically speaking, all these endeavors were very, very minute, very, very small. The moment that the diplomacy started to work, even this action had stopped. And the idea was, don't waste time on fighting white paper that anyhow will be gone with the British colonialism. Just waste time to build your forces, because you need to face an ominous and very dangerous war against the Arab world. And I think this was a great decision to stop to fight a white paper that anyhow will be ended somehow by global development. The result is that I cannot show you a heroic museum of anti-white paper in Israel, because there were no anti-white paper. Yeah. I can show you the Palmach Museum, I can show you the Irgun Museum, I can show you the Lehi Museum, but by and large, as an historian, yeah, these are very small actions. And when you ask me, good for that. Because otherwise we will engage in what the Palestinians have, this great Arab revolt, against something that somehow break their power.
Okay, I have also a question concerning the Arab revolt, you called it. I think it's controversial whether these incidents in Haifa can be called anti-Semitic or anti-Semitic pogroms also. And my question is about the European situation at that time. Were these incidents discussed among the Jews in Europe, and also maybe the threat of anti-Semitism in the Middle East, if you consider the cooperation of al-Husseini and Hitler?
Yeah. Well, at that time, the Arab revolt was somehow caught the Yeshua by surprise. And I don't think that incidents in Haifa were perceived as anti-Semitic and were perceived as anti-Israeli. Husseini connection with the Nazis were really viewed as Arab anti-Semitism for a short period. And yes, you are right that from a Zionist point of view, the whole behavior of the Palestinian leadership, especially Husseini, and its alliance with Hitler and with this Bosnian Muslim pro-Nazi group, made the narrative that, yes, the Palestinians are pro-Nazi. But I don't think they were pro-Nazi. They were simply, I mean, there were some people pro-Nazi, obviously. But there were more Palestinians who were recruited to the British army than to Hitler's army, that no one knows about them. There were, unlike the Jews, that were recruited in mass numbers. So the situation was much more complicated. But at a certain point, the anti-British Arab nationalism that took place in Iraq and in Egypt and in Palestine can be viewed as a pro-Nazi activities, and Italy and Germany supported this kind of revolt out of political consideration. Yeah. So I don't know if I give you a direct answer, but it was perceived, but I think as a historian we should be more delicate and not to say all kind of very general statement like, you know, Haj Amin al-Husseini was like the Nazi. Yeah.
Are there any more questions? Okay, if not, thank you very much, Professor Nave.
Thank you very much, and good night.